This is the Thrive Content Clubcast.
Hi, I'm Megan, a learning designer here at Thrive. Today I'm going to be speaking to Izzy from the Revenge Porn Helpline about what revenge porn is, the effects, and how to support those going through it. So, Izzy, if you could start by just giving us a little bit of introduction about yourself and your role.
Yes, so my name's Izzy. I work on the Revenge Porn Helpline. We're operated by Southwest Good for Learning, which is a charity. We're based in Exeter. So in terms of kind of my role, so like I said, I work as a helpline practitioner. So that's kind of supporting anyone who's been affected by intimate image abuse, lives in the UK and is over the age of 18. So in terms of the helpline itself, we're a practical support service. So we work within a remit where we can help to report and remove private sexual content when it's been posted publicly online without consent, but we also offer sort of advice and support around kind of intimate image abuse in general, sort of advice on how to report to the police, and kind of emotional support, signposting, and yeah, we're just here to support anyone who's been affected by intimate image abuse, basically.
Great, fantastic, thank you. I guess we'll sort of start from the beginning, because I think for a lot of people it's quite a new concept.
Yeah.
So for you, what would you really define revenge porn as? Because it's quite complicated when it comes to actually defining the crime itself. What would you say in your words?
Yeah, so in terms of, yeah, in terms of kind of intimate image abuse in general, so on the helpline we call it intimate image abuse. Mm-hmm. Even though we're called the Revenge Porn Helpline, we absolutely know that it is never done as revenge, and it absolutely isn't porn. It's non-consensual intimate image abuse. But in terms of kind of people being able to find our helpline, we do call ourselves the Revenge Porn Helpline, as that's obviously what is kind of known as in the media. Mm-hmm. And the most important thing for us is that we're obviously accessible and that people are able to kind of find the helpline when they need to. But yeah, I suppose in terms of revenge porn and intimate image abuse in general, it's a difficult thing to define. I think, yeah, I suppose in relation to the law kind of states it's against the law in the UK to share an intimate image or video without consent with the intent to cause distress. But I suppose in terms of intimate image abuse in general, it could be sort of a whole host of things. People, yeah, having their images shared without their consent, being recorded without their consent, receiving threats for their intimate images to be shared. There's definitely a whole host of behaviours that kind of make up intimate image abuse and revenge porn in general, if that makes sense. But yeah, I agree. It is a really complicated one. It's a difficult one to explain.
Yeah, definitely. And I think since it became a crime in sort of 2015, it's still confusing. As you've said, it's all about the intent.
Yes. Yeah. Which it absolutely shouldn't be. I hopefully there's changes coming to the law to kind of take that away. And so hopefully everyone can get the legal justice that they deserve, regardless of whether that intent can be proven. But yeah, I think we know that sort of regardless, it's going to cause distress, isn't it, if you've had your intimate images shared non-consensually, kind of regardless of whether or not that can be proven.
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of sort of, I know you've talked about it briefly, about what you offer at the Revenge Porn Helpline.
Yeah.
So what happens when someone does approach you to say, you know, I've had my images either shared or taken in secret from me? Mm-hmm. What's your sort of first response?
Yeah, so in terms of kind of, so people can contact us obviously via phone, via email, or we've got an anonymous reporting form and a chat bot as well. So there's quite a few different ways that people can contact us. Obviously we know that lots of people would rather kind of speak over email or over an anonymous reporting form rather than having to call up. That can feel really, really daunting. But again, for some other people, it is really nice to kind of have that voice at the end of the phone. Mm-hmm. When you're kind of discussing what's happened with someone. But yeah, I suppose people call us up or email in, usually sort of explain a little bit about what's happened and why they're contacting us. We will then kind of explain a little bit about the law and whether what's happened to them could potentially have broken the law. We'll sort of advise about them reporting to the police, signpost often to some other kind of free legal advice. We work along a project called SPITE, which is run by the Queen Mary's University in London. Mm-hmm. They're amazing. They offer free legal advice to anybody who's been affected by intimate image abuse. So we'll often signpost there. And yeah, and then in terms of kind of, like I said, we're a practical support service. So obviously, if people have had their images shared publicly online, so that means like publicly onto social media or onto like an adult site, for instance, non-consensually, and the picture is of, if is of a private sexual nature, then we can help with reporting that for removal. We can't obviously guarantee any removals, but we do hold a really high takedown rate. Well, we're very sort of, we're a determined team, so we'll always try our very best to get everything removed that we can.
So how do you go about removing them? What sort of powers do you have there?
Yeah, so we have a really, really good relationship with lots of the adult sites, and the social media platforms as well. We're a trusted flagger with lots of the social media platforms, which means that we've kind of got direct reporting routes with them. But yeah, I mean, it's a very kind of manual process. So it is literally sending an email out to the website or the hosting provider, which is like the umbrella company that owns the website, and explaining that the content's been uploaded non-consensually and asking for it to be removed, essentially. But yeah, like I said, I think we've got a really good relationship with a lot of the adult sites and other places that content tends to be shared, which can mean that it's hopefully lots of websites are cooperative. But yeah, like I said, we can't sort of guarantee any removals, unfortunately, which is really, really frustrating. But yeah, we'll always try our best.
Yeah, so I think, say you guys help with people that have had their images shared publicly online. I think the sort of general view of intimate image abuse, revenge porn, especially because of sort of the rise of it happening in the public eye, you know, Lara McDermott, her documentary, Georgia Harrison, her trial. I think most people assume it's pictures that someone has perhaps sent to a partner or someone that they're speaking to, and they've taken them and they've shared them. I would say that's the most common sort of view of it. There is a lot more ways that revenge porn can happen.
Yeah.
So what do you sort of see coming through your helpline? What sort of different ways are there that this crime happens?
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, absolutely. A lot of the kind of typical sort of revenge porn, intimate image abuse cases are where the content's been sort of shared by an ex-partner. Like you sort of said, that's kind of how we sort of all imagine it. And that is a lot of what we see. And in relation to kind of, especially how women are affected by intimate image abuse, that is what we see in the majority of cases, that it's sort of shared by a known person, someone that they kind of trusted to have the image, I suppose, like a partner or potentially sometimes friends, family members, a whole host of kind of different ways that the content is shared. Sometimes we see that people's kind of Snapchats have been hacked or iClouds have been hacked and the content's been accessed that way. We are seeing a lot of something called sextortion as well, which is kind of, it's a slightly different type of crime, but we absolutely support with it on the helpline as well. So sextortion, it's very different in that it tends to be experienced by men. So it kind of works in a way that people are contacted by like a catfish account, often sort of over social media. So over kind of the bigger sort of social media platforms, they'll kind of start chatting to that person. The person will look very, very real, and they'll persuade the victim into exchanging intimate content. Then once they've got those pictures or videos of you, that's when they'll kind of very quickly change their tune, and that's when they'll start blackmailing people and asking them for money. Our sort of understanding is this is perpetrated by criminal gangs that are based abroad. So that's kind of, we see a lot of that on the helpline. In terms of 2022, that took up 30% of our caseload, were these sextortion type cases. So we do get a lot of that on the helpline. But yeah, I suppose in relation to kind of typical sort of revenge porn and intimate image abuse, yeah, it is often that kind of typical thing, like you explained, of pictures being shared by kind of a known person often an ex-partner or someone that they were with.
There's an element of sort of technology to this crime as well.
Yeah.
Is this a relatively new thing? Sort of, when did you guys when were you established as an organization, and how much have you seen your sort of helplines be contacted more?
So yeah, with the rise in technology, unfortunately the crime is rising as well, and yeah, cases have risen sort of across the helpline hugely. I think sort of potentially this is going to be our busiest year we've had. Yeah, so in relation to the helpline being set up, so we were set up in 2015, and we were established alongside the law change. So when that intimate image abuse law came into place, so that's when the helpline was established. And yeah, since then there's just been a huge rise in cases since it started, and that definitely has come alongside the rise in technology and social media. I suppose in terms of kind of how technology is used now, we're all using it so much more frequently than we were even back in 2015, which really wasn't actually that long ago. But I suppose the way that technology has come on since then is crazy, and it is sort of a very normal part and a healthy part of lots of adult relationships to share content consensually with a partner or someone that you trust or someone that you even just like the look of. And there's absolutely nothing wrong doing that. And kind of our sort of message on the helpline and our absolute opinion is that the only fault lies with the people who then go on to choose to share that content non-consensually.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a huge part of it, that there's a huge stigma around it. Because there are a lot of people that would say, well, why did you share that image in the first place? You know, why? Maybe we should be telling people not to take those images at all. But as you say, it's going to happen. It's a very common thing, and it's a very normal thing to share that with people that you trust and you're in a relationship with, or even not.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a healthy and it's a really normal thing to do, like you said. And yeah, the only fault lies with people who are then going on to share that content non-consensually. Absolutely.
So why do you think that stigma exists? Is it because there's a gap between perhaps the younger and the older generation because of that technology? You know, the older generation weren't able to do this per se. So is that a reason for the stigma? What's sort of the issue there?
Yeah, I suppose it is really difficult to know. I suppose that could absolutely be a part of it. I suppose with technology growing and changing so quickly, it's hard for everyone, I suppose, to potentially get their head around kind of the way that technology is now being used. And it's only going to be used in that way more frequently as time goes on and technology gets better. And there isn't anything wrong with that, absolutely. But yeah, I suppose there are obviously some terrible things that are then done with that, but yeah, absolutely. In relation to kind of technology sort of changing and growing, I think that does definitely play an impact. But yeah, there shouldn't be a stigma, and that's something that we kind of definitely agree with and want to sort of spread awareness about, that it's never the person who's been affected's fault. It's never your fault if you've shared an image. The only fault lies with the person who's going on to choose to share that.
Yeah, absolutely. So how do we tackle this stigma? You know, sort of what advice can we put out? You know, perhaps someone who's listening to this and isn't aware really of what revenge porn is or how it affects people. What can we say to those people to sort of stop this message spreading?
Yeah, I think it's just important to keep the conversation going, and keep speaking about the fact that there's nothing wrong with consensually sharing your images. And like I've sort of keep repeating myself, but the only fault lies with the people who are sharing this content non-consensually. And yeah, I suppose it's if you know someone who's been affected by intimate image abuse or has had their images shared, it's just a case of being non-judgmental, being open. And understanding that they've experienced a form of abuse and they've absolutely not done anything wrong.
Yeah. So when it comes to sort of supporting sort of survivors of intimate image abuse, what would you recommend? That obviously we've just touched on it there about, you know, just non-judgmental, honest, open communication.
Yeah.
I think people would struggle really with what to say because of those preconceptions and that stigma as well. So how do you tackle that when a friend or a family member comes to you and says this has happened? How do we approach that?
Yeah, I think, like I said, it is a form of abuse, and it's absolutely sort of treating it as that. In the same way, if your friend came to you about a different form of abuse, it's treating it the same. It's like I said, being non-judgmental, listening to whoever's come to you, and supporting them as best you can. And yeah, I really do think the best way to do that is by being non-judgmental, and just listening to kind of how they're feeling, and just accepting and understanding that they've experienced abuse, and they absolutely deserve support for what's happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the sort of other side of that as well, what should we encourage people to go to the police if they, even if they are, not comfortable? If you're a friend and family member, should you be pushing people to go to the police? Is it important?
Yeah, I think in terms of sort of our advice on the helpline and kind of my own sort of personal opinion, I think it's really important to encourage people to do whatever they feel most comfortable with. If someone's eager to report to the police, then absolutely, we will always encourage people to report to the police, and really appreciate that for a lot of people, it is really important to get that legal justice for what's happened. But if people don't feel comfortable reporting to the police, like I said earlier, we often signpost to other free legal advice services. So for instance, the Queen Mary's University in London, they offer amazing free legal advice through their Project Spite. So we often signpost people there, and to Rights of Women as well, who operate a free legal advice helpline. As it can be a really daunting thing to report to the police, and it can also really help if you're well informed when you are making a report, so you kind of understand exactly what the police should be doing to support you.
Yeah. What about if you're a person who's received these images, perhaps, I mean, in the ways that we know that it happens, perhaps on a WhatsApp text chain, over your work email, if these images landed in your inbox of someone that you know, is it then your duty to report that to the police?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think that's quite a difficult question. I would always encourage people to do what they think the victim would want to happen, if that makes sense. So for instance, if you've had your images, if your friends had their images shared, if you feel able to, speaking to that person about it, to ensure that they kind of feel comfortable, I suppose, with that happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you say, I think it is really difficult, that line,
Yeah.
especially when it comes to your sort of your workplace as well, because there are cases where it has happened that these images have been shared across a person's workplace. And in which case, is it then not the duty of the workplace to report that to the police? Because those images are being shared sort of on their network, what sort of happens then when it involves your employer?
Yeah, I mean, again, in relation to kind of what we would advise on the helpline, I suppose if they felt comfortable to speaking to a member of the kind of HR team, we often signpost people to ACAS as well. So they're an organisation that can offer sort of workplace advice around workplace rights and regulations. So yeah, we would absolutely signpost to ACAS, and be encouraging them to get in touch with them.
Yeah, so for sort of first port of call when it comes to sort of the workplace being involved is go and see your sort of HR representative.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, I suppose it kind of depends from organisation to organisation. It's not something that we sort of advise on in great detail. But yeah, I mean, we would definitely be encouraging people to contact ACAS, and they would kind of be able to give some better advice around that.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, I know it's not really sort of your area, but what would you sort of expect workplaces to do, just on I guess an emotional level and a human level?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, you really hope that people would come at it from a human level, absolutely, and be empathetic, and understanding, and really appreciate that this person has been a victim of a crime. So that would absolutely be our sort of best advice, and we really hope that that's how everybody's workplace would react to that.
Absolutely. And sort of going back to the importance of sort of reporting to the police, how often do you speak to someone who's actually willing to go to the police?
It really differs. So, like I said, some people will kind of openly say at the start of the conversation that they don't want to report to the police. It's not something that they feel comfortable doing, for sort of a whole host of reasons. And other times people are sort of very eager to report to the police, and they're sort of specifically contacting us to double check that whatever's happened to them is against the law. Mm-hmm. And sort of ask some questions about kind of specifically what the police might be able to do. But yeah, I think it really, really differs from case to case. But yeah, absolutely, often people are very eager to report to the police. And if that's kind of how people feel and they feel comfortable reporting, we really encourage that.
Do you work with the police at all in these cases to sort of help provide evidence and give sort of statements on it?
Yeah, absolutely. So in relation to, we, a lot of our cases are sort of quite big and will go on for a sort of a long period of time, and often in those cases the police will sort of contact us directly and ask for evidence, whether that be image links to where the content's been shared online, or kind of statements around kind of when the person who's experienced intimate image abuse has contacted us. But yeah, oftentimes it's kind of showing evidence as to where the content's been shared.
Mm-hmm. And if you're able to share this, I was wondering sort of, how often is it that a case that you know about and you've helped sort of report to the police? How often is there a conviction there?
Yeah, so unfortunately conviction rates are really low, which is really, really frustrating and really disappointing. And hopefully something that's going to change with kind of the law change that's hopefully coming up. Yeah, they're not as high as they should be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is really sad, but hopefully that's something that's going to change in the future.
Yeah, as you say, I think that's probably down to the wording of the law, the sort of
absolutely
intent.
Yes, exactly that. And there's the law at the moment doesn't protect people in the way that it should. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that people can get justice for what's happened to them. So yeah, that's why that law change is so important, and hopefully will mean that more people can get the kind of legal justice for what's happened, because we completely appreciate that. It's so important for people, and is a huge sort of part of their kind of their journey, and at least then they can have had some justice for what's happened.
Mm-hmm. And you say that law changes is coming up. What's sort of happening in that space at the moment to help aid that?
Yeah, so I mean it's a bit of a confusing one that I absolutely cannot explain in any sort of great detail, but yeah, hopefully the law is kind of changing, as we all sort of know, with the online safety bill, and hopefully in the next sort of coming months there will be kind of in place, and it will hopefully potentially getting rid of that intent to cause distress.
Yeah.
And it will be sort of broader, to encompass more, and like I said, kind of ensure that people can get some legal justice for what's happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And my next question was sort of, why do you think it is that some people don't want to report to the police? But we've covered that a little bit, I guess, with the intent part of the law.
Yeah.
But do you think there's sort of a distrust that the case won't be taken seriously, or how what's happened sort of in the past with cases that haven't led to a conviction? Has that put people off? Or
yeah, I think absolutely, and I think people know that that conviction rates are sort of unfortunately really low. Mm-hmm. which can mean that the sort of trauma of reporting, it can be sort of quite a traumatic experience for people to go through the whole process of reporting what's happened, potentially go through a court case to then for to not get the kind of the win that they deserve at the end. Mm-hmm. So I think that entire process can be sort of really draining and potentially not feel that it's worth it. And yeah, I think unfortunately there is sort of a stigma around the police that cases might not potentially be taken seriously. We really, really hope that that isn't the case, but we know that in some cases it is the case. But hopefully, sort of with kind of more education, and I think with some of the big cases that have been in the media, obviously sort of Georgia Harrison's case in particular, I think that's really helped to sort of spread awareness about how much of an impact this does have on people, and how important it is for people to get that justice that they really, really do deserve.
Yeah, absolutely. And we spoke a bit about the effect that it does have on people. And I know you guys don't offer that sort of emotional support. It's more sort of practical. But I guess you do have some exposure to the effect that this does have on people's lives. And I think the general public perhaps isn't so much aware of how sort of debilitating this can be. So what have you seen with people coming through?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of kind of, we often hear that people sort of say that they feel sort of extremely violated by what's happened. We sort of completely understand that it's an extremely distressing thing for people to go through. And it can take a huge emotional toll. In terms of kind of, like I said, we're not sort of a long-term emotional support service. So I suppose we don't kind of often talk to people about their kind of emotional well-being for kind of a long period of time. We always obviously make sure that we signpost people onto to services that are able to support them in that way. But yeah, I mean, it's obviously an extremely violating thing to experience and absolutely can take a huge, huge, huge toll on people.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I guess my sort of final question is, I guess just for you to be able to say how best to support people and, you know, signposts to the organisations that you work with, and sort of your final thoughts on the matter and anything that you'd like to put out there.
Yeah, so I mean, if you've over 18 and have been affected by intimate image abuse, please don't hesitate to get in touch. We're here to help. There are lots of other organisations who are also here to help that we can signpost you to. Our sort of main message that we want to get across is that you absolutely haven't done anything wrong. Whatever has happened is not your fault. And there are people here to support you.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining me today, Izzy. It's been great chatting to you.
No problem.
You've been listening to the Thrive Content Podcast. Visit www.thrivelearning.com for more information. Be bold. Be brave. Thrive.